This is a session on gender and worship by Rosemary Ruther. And I was starting to say that I'm going to be working with material from this book on feminist liturgical communities and worship. And this is, I'm thinking of this session very much as a hands-on kind of session, that is to say, to get people involved in actual brainstorming ideas on worship and doing some writing, hopefully, and sharing of some writing. So I'd like to just, this will be a kind of introductory session on that. And I'd like to start out talking about the idea of covenant and covenanted communities. About 10 years or so ago, my husband and I belonged to a community that was actually started by John and Mary Schramm, and was an ecumenical community. And they modeled it very much on the idea of covenanted community. We community re-covenanted every 6 months, and the covenanting really meant that we spent some time reflecting on what we wanted to do in our life together and making some kinds of commitments to do those things, and then, in effect, sort of signing a book of the covenant, which indicated that for the next 6 months we committed ourselves to do certain things. And that got me started on thinking about the idea of covenanting and covenant communities as an idea. The idea of covenant, of course, goes back to ancient Israelite concepts. One talks about the Old Covenant, various covenants of God with Israel. And I think covenant, I think, also implies not only a relationship between God and the community, but also it implies a relationship of the members of the community with each other. It certainly implies that the members of the community, adult members of the community, are all accepted as persons who are able to freely enter into a covenant together, and who are in turn affirmed as persons. A few years ago, a Jewish feminist friend of mine, who comes from the Orthodox Jewish tradition, I was starting to say that talking about covenant and the idea of covenanted communities, both as small intentional communities and also the biblical idea of covenant. And I was starting to mention a friend of mine named Raquel Adler, who comes from the Orthodox Jewish community and has written a number of essays. I don't know that she's actually ever written a book yet. I think she will be a major person who's emerging. She's a Talmud scholar. And she wrote an article that I think, a tremendously powerful article, called "Should Jewish Women Re-Covenant?" And what she basically implies in that is that women, in a sense, were never really included in the Jewish covenant. And she talks about the basic stories about the forming of the covenant, certainly the most important story for the making of the covenant is the giving of the law at Sinai. That's for Judaism seen as a kind of key moment, or there may be a series of earlier covenants, but that's the climactic moment of entering into the relationship between God and Israel and the giving of the law. And if you look at that story, you see that in the Exodus, women have all kinds of participation in setting the stage for the Exodus. The mother and sister of Moses and the daughter of Pharaoh kind of do the first actions that begin the whole drama of the Exodus. Miriam is one of the leaders of the Jewish community, the Exodus, the Hebrew community. And yet when you get to the story of the giving of the law, at Sinai, you have this startling statement which says that those who gather together, the children of Israel who gather together to receive the law, should prepare themselves for this momentous experience of the revelation of God by not going near a woman for 3 days. And of course that reflects a whole lot of later Jewish practices of excluding women from study and seeing women as impure and so on. But to have that kind of concept shape that particular story is particularly hurtful for Jewish women, because what it really sort of suggests is that at the moment when the law is given to Israel, in effect it's given to male Israel, and that not only are women not there, they are in fact excluded as a polluting element. And so she talks about Jewish women sort of, maybe they were kind of eavesdropping around the other side of the mountain while God was talking to the males of Israel. In that kind of sense, that women really are not adult partners in the covenant is reflected in a number of basic practices in the Jewish tradition. It's reflected in the notion that in order to have a minyan, that is to say the minimum number to make a synagogue or a praying community, you have to have 10 adult males. And those women, classically women, were not even counted as members of a synagogue. They sat up in the balcony behind a veil, they couldn't even participate, and so on. Now some of that, of course, has been changed in Reform Judaism, more recently in Conservative Judaism. But that's still a very powerful long tradition, that notion, as well as, of course, the basic rituals of initiation into the covenant are exclusively male initiation rites. The circumcision, needless to say, which is the rite of initiation into the covenant, is a male, exclusively male rite. And the bar mitzvah traditionally was also only males as well. So all the way along the line, there is that built-in structure, patriarchal structure, in which it is males and adult males who are the community of Israel. And women are simply invisible. They are never adult members who enter in to the covenant in their own right. They're sort of included under it, you might say, like children are included under it, but they're never really consulted or able to represent themselves. So all of that is what she's thinking about when she says, should Jewish women read covenant? In other words, that women in a real sense were never included in the covenant. Now, what I'd like to start asking this afternoon is that equally true for Christian women? Should Christian women read covenant? Is there a sense that Christian women really have never been fully included in what we call the New Covenant? I would say the situation on the theological and shall we say sacramental side is significantly better for Christian women. In fact, I would say that there is a, it's precisely at that moment that you see a kind of breakthrough that, in spite of my nervousness about setting the New Covenant in a critique of Hebrew Covenant, there certainly is a kind of new inclusiveness that is going on there in the language about the New Covenant, in terms of precisely the notion that that gender differences are overcome, that in Christ there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, whereas all those different, that exclusivity of race but also of gender, is very theologically explicitly said to be overcome. And that text, Galatians 3:28, that talks about overcoming distinctions of gender and race and class, neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, is almost surely a baptismal text. In other words, it is talking about the theology of newness in Christ, but it it's thinking particularly about baptism. And of course, the ritual of baptism, the basic initiation rite of Christianity, is a inclusive ritual. I mean, men and women are in no way second-class citizens in baptism. And in fact, if you want to look at the history of baptism, it goes back to Jewish water purification rites, which originally were for women and Gentiles, but not for Jewish men. So that Christianity, in effect, takes precisely that ritual, which was used to indicate the inferior position of both women and Gentiles, and uses it to be the inclusive ritual for the new humanity. So I think in terms of theology and in terms of the basic initiation rituals of baptism and also confirmation, women are included in ways in which they were not included in the same way in the Old Covenant. And yet I would say that in spite of the important starting point, there's a sense in which the Christian community has also failed to make good that full inclusion of women in the New Covenant. And I think the basic way it has failed to make good is a roughly 1960-year or 70-year, depending on the denomination, and in some cases 80 and 90-year history of excluding women from ministry as preachers, as ordained ministers, and so on. In other words, if you're really serious about women being fully included in baptism, then you have to be equally serious, and that they are equally in the new humanity in Christ, then you have to be equally serious that women are included in the ministry of the community. Ministry flows from baptism. It's not some sort of separate, special kind of thing. Although some have obviously tried to make it that. But it's rooted in the ministry of the community and the setting aside of people to minister to the whole community. But as soon as you say that one group, such as only men or only white people or something like that, are the only appropriate ministers, you're really denying the full baptism, the full inclusion in salvation of those people who are excluded. So I think it's precisely at that point that we find Christianity in practice having, shall we say, slipped back into patriarchal patterns and not taking fully seriously its own initial insights that the new covenant is one in which these divisions of male and female are overcome in the new humanity in Christ. And that exclusion from ministry you have to realize that has shaped Christian practice for almost all of its history, except for last 20, 30 years for most denominations. There are a few denominations, such as the Congregationalists, who began to ordain women a bit earlier in the mid-19th century. But for all practical purposes, any real, significant, visible women in ordained ministry is roughly the last 20, 25 years. And I think that has made an overwhelming impact on the way in which theology has been done. It means that only men who could be ordained really were admitted to those places where the theology was shaped. In a sense, women were excluded then from higher theological studies because they weren't in preparation for ministry. Women were excluded from the actual doing of theology, public preaching and teaching, and so on. A whole kind of symbol system developed in terms of both theology and worship and so on that in effect justified an imagery of the church in which male over female was seen as somehow the model for God over creatures and so on. So I think we're just beginning to realize the ramifications of of that long history of exclusion of women from ministry, and the fact that, some women are now being included is in fact an enormously revolutionary development. Was that, I think what many denominations have done is thought that you would just kind of slip a few women into the same kind of clerical roles and then just everything would go on as before. And I think we're just beginning to realize that that the implications of including women are much more revolutionary than that. It begins to challenge a whole kind of imagery of the pastor and laity, a whole kind of symbol system modeled on maleness as the word of God and as God, and femaleness as the symbol of those who are to be ruled over and to be passive and receptive and so on. So I think we have to be, if we're going to think about, shall we say, not so much a re-covenanting, but a kind of re-envisioning of the Christian covenant in order to fully claim, to fully make visible and active that original vision of the new covenant in which there men and women are fully included in the new humanity of Christ. I think we're going to have to think much more deeply about language, about theology, about church structure, ministry, and then finally about the mission or practice of the church. And let me just try to say a few things about that. In terms of language, people often hear that in terms of questions of inclusive language, and certainly that's one implication of including women, that one now has to question any kind of use of male generic language that assumes that somehow the male is the appropriate collective representative of the human race and of God, and start using language that really fully affirms both men and women. But I think it's more than just throwing a few she's in with the he's, so to speak. It really means rethinking a whole way in which gender is a symbol of hierarchy. So I think I'm saying that the language question is not just a kind of quick adaptation. I think we need to go much more deeper into the symbolism of language. That was my topic a week or two, so I'm not going to get into detail on that, but just lift that up. I think another aspect is really looking at the structure of ministry itself. I think that a lot of the way in which Christians have structured ministry, and some denominations are more flagrant than others, because of course the Reformation attempted to change some of this. But I think a lot of the patterning of ministry is really based on what I would call a clericalism. And I like to distinguish between clericalism and ministry. To me, the word clericalism is in fact the opposite of ministry. So let me just try to define how I distinguish between clericalism and ministry. For me, clericalism, the word clericalism for me isn't only something that happens in the church, it also happens in a lot of professions. It's a way of exercising power by a professional class, by which this professional class sort of monopolizes all the knowledge and all the legitimacy for doing this particular role or service in such a way as to render the people who are served dependent and powerless and essentially ignorant. So that the kind of ministry that's done in the clericalistic way sort of manufactures people who need the professional in order to have health or have relationship to God or be able to understand the scriptures and so on. But receiving that service from that professional never really enables you to know how to do those things for yourself. Is it clear what I mean? In other words, you can go to the doctor all your life, and you never, and he'll prescribe endless prescriptions, and usually he doesn't even bother to tell you what the prescription is, you know. I mean, if you ask him, well, what is that prescription? And often he looks slightly annoyed. And so, you know, you never really actually know how to heal yourself anymore by going to most doctors. There are maybe a few exceptions. And to me, that's a clericalistic kind of health practice in which you essentially are dependent on a kind of expertise. But receiving that expertise never sort of enables you in any way to become able to take care of yourself. And so to me, that's a kind of clericalistic way of doing service. And I think that we've often modeled Christian ministry on that clericalistic model. Those who are ordained are the only ones who can legitimately baptize into the Eucharist. They alone really know how to interpret the scriptures. They alone can preach. In some denominations, they monopolize administration as well. And so the people really become the consumers of ministry rather than participants in it. The traditional Catholic joke about that is that the role of the laity is to pray, pay, and obey. Hopefully the Lutherans will be better than that. They did have some claims about the priesthood of all believers and so on, which is, of course, an attempt to reappropriate ministry to the people. But in fact, I think there's always a kind of creeping clericalism that goes on in church structures, even though they may attempt to overcome that theologically. The creeping clericalism I think, is basically expressed by the notion that ministry belongs to the ordained, and the laity are there to receive the ministry from the ordained, rather than what I think is the appropriate Christian model, which is that the base of ministry is the ministry of the people. Ministry flows from baptism. It is basically a function of the whole community, who are a ministering community, ministering to each other, ministering and witness to the world. You know, the professionals are there to essentially to enable them to do the ministry of the community, to enable them through teaching. In other words, if a minister is a good teacher, he essentially draws the community into mutual learning. So they begin to gain some of the tools of theological reflection themselves, and they begin to become a theologically reflective community rather than just, you know, asking him for all the answers, or perhaps even her for all the answers. And similarly, it seems to me that a worshiping community needs to become involved in articulating its symbols and participating in the development of liturgy, rather than simply seeing themselves as passive consumers. So what I'm suggesting is the inclusion of women in ministry, I think, needs to go beyond simply adding a few women to a basically hierarchical structure and begin to think about a much more participatory concept of ministry. And my own belief is that unless we develop a more participatory concept of ministry, we will never have more than token women in ministry. Because the basic symbolism is father-children. And so women will always be seen as anomalous if the basic model of the ordained to the laity is father-children. Let alone sheep. I mean, whenever I hear somebody referring to me as a sheep, I always have this great desire to go, you know, make a little sheep-like protest. So I'm saying that the inclusion of women means a kind of rethinking of community, rethinking of the symbolism, the language, rethinking of the way in which ministry and community are related. Rethinking, I think, the mission of the church. What is the church about? How does it really express its commitment to redeemed humanity, redeemed earth? Does it do that simply by putting most of its resources into building, maintenance, or does it do that by much more concrete commitments helping the members realize their own, really genuine pastoring of the members, as well as some kind of commitments to social transformation. And I think if one is serious about redemption from sexism, redemption from patriarchy as a part of the meaning of the new humanity in Christ, and I think that part of the mission of the church must be to witness for those kinds of transformations in society. And to put it quite simply and directly, a church that really understands the full inclusion of women as a part of redemption in Christ would not go about campaigning against the Equal Rights Amendment, or would not simply be neutral on the Equal Rights Amendment. Obviously, it would understand that that is a social expression of its own commitment. So I think what I'm basically saying is being serious about full inclusion of women has implications for our understanding of the mission and ministry of the church. Okay, let me then say, how are we doing here in time? What I have in mind with some of the ideas of liturgy. In the last 20, 25 years, there of course has been enormous numbers of women going to seminaries and trying to get ordained, trying to get jobs. Some denominations are ordaining women. In some cases, women went to seminary before they could be ordained and then struggled to get ordained. Then, of course, after you're ordained, they have to go to church. And one finds all kinds of structures sort of as obstacles and blockades almost at every step of the way. And although certainly women are continuing to commit themselves to that kind of structural participation in the mainline institutions, I think women who've been engaged in this kind of struggle find that they're burning out. Finding that they're often out in isolated communities, very little, the kind of conversation, for example, about feminism that they might have had in seminaries simply is not out in rural Saskatchewan or whatever, and the kind of struggles to be recognized as one woman pastor in communities where maybe you're the only one or only two of you. All of this is the toll of personal hurt and frustration and burnout is enormously high. I have a kind of sneaking suspicion that that's part of the intention. I think that the church is doing the churches are doing a kind of a double-handed thing. They're saying, well, yes, we now agree this is the right thing, women should be ordained, and we hope they'll get some jobs, but they're doing very little to help them get jobs. And then they're kind of looking the other way as they fall by the wayside. And then they'll say, well, isn't that funny? We graduated 50% women, but it turned out we only ordained about 5%. And we only employed about 5%, and then they seem to have all disappeared. In other words, I think the church is not prepared to have more than token women, and letting women burn out is a way of disposing of larger numbers than you really want to cope with. So I think all of that has suggested to women, and not only women, because certainly there are men that are sympathetic to this question as well, that one needs to construct some support communities. One needs to support communities for simply talking together, for sharing problems and so on. But as some of those support communities have developed, they have also begun to fill the need for a certain kind of religious nurture. In other words, they have become prayer communities, not simply just talk communities or coffee clutches or whatever, but they have taken on a dimension of being worship communities. And in those kind of worship communities, small worship communities where people gather together to support themselves in this venture of transforming the church for full inclusion of women, obviously you have a much freer ambience for experimenting with liturgy and song and symbol and so on. So I find that there's sort of sprouting up all over the United States, and I could mention some communities in England and Europe as well. What I would call feminist-based communities. Are you familiar with the term base community? That's a term that's been very widespread in Latin America among liberation people committed to a liberation Christianity. Small intentional communities where people, you might say it's kind of the prayer and worship dimension of some kind of commitment to social justice. And so I think the concept of women church has begun to emerge as an effort to express this need for a worship dimension of the feminist struggle in the church. Very typically, those kind of worship communities are often ecumenical. In other words, even though a person might be a Lutheran or might be a Catholic or might be Methodist or whatever, they might gather with 18 other people with similar issues and concerns who might come from a variety of different denominations. So even though, in a sense, they're smaller than your average parish, in another sense, they're more universal. They express more of the universal church in that they tend to be ecumenical. I don't see anybody having any great desire to start a new denomination. This is always, you know, something where, oh, I'm going to start a new denomination. I don't think anybody that I know of is interested in starting a feminist denomination any more than other kinds of support groups that have developed in the churches want to start new denominations. So I think that one should see the relationship of such small worship communities to the institutions as a kind of, should we say, kind of leaven, and effort, a kind of experimental community, a support community, which can both nurture people in a larger struggle, but also generate a new culture, a new creativity, which can then be fed back into larger organizations and gatherings and so on. You might say this class right here is an example of that. It was, I'm sort of sharing stuff that has emerged in these kind of small communities with gatherings of people who probably wouldn't encounter these kinds of communities in your regular parish life. So I see these kind of feminist communities as a place where both nurture and support is going on for people who are trying to do this kind of transformation of the church and otherwise might feel very isolated and burned out. But it also is a place for generating new culture. I think any kind of transforming vision of the church generates a new culture. It's certainly true in the Reformation. You have not only new creeds, but, you know, enormous numbers of new songs and new theology and so on. So any kind of important renewal of the church generates a new culture to express it. Not totally new, but we're not talking about a new religion, but we're talking about a culture that can now begin to include this dimension of equality and mutuality of men and women that has tended to be very much slighted in the Christian tradition. I certainly am interested in that not just being women's groups, but also that men start to think about how they have been distorted, their full humanity has been distorted by their kinds of roles, and that we're really aiming, in effect, at a new kind of community of men and women through this kind of process, and developing forms of worship that would express that. Now, what I'd like to ask you all this afternoon as a kind of preparation for the next three sessions, what I'd like you is to do is to spend about maybe about 10 minutes or so in groups of three or four, just exploring areas where you feel liturgically deprived. Now, that may be sort of a startling idea to you. I mean, maybe you feel you're not liturgically deprived. But let me try to explain what I mean by that. I think the church has been very rich on certain kinds of initiation rites. It has been very poor on various kinds of transition and ending rites. People get married with tremendous pomp and circumstance. When their marriage falls apart, they find very little to help them, you might say, a healing liturgy of divorce by which they might create the sort of reconciliation that would allow them to go on to a new stage of life. The church is pretty poor on that kind of ending liturgy. I think the church is pretty poor on a lot of healing areas, certainly areas of violence to women. There's almost no way in which women who've experienced those kinds of things, not only do they not have kind of healing from the church, but they really almost feel like they can't let anybody in church know that that's happened. That would be somehow shameful, they would be somehow discarded by the church. There are all kinds of experiences where people, in order to maintain a sort of facade of being good Christian people, have to pretend that a lot of things aren't really happening. Violence in the family, battering, all kinds of things, which instead of the church offering means of healing, and here I'm talking about a kind of should we say a worship dimension of that. There's obviously pastoral counseling as well, which is also a legitimate aspect of that. But there's very little by which the church helps people through those kinds of things. There was one of my students, I teach at a predominantly Methodist seminary, and one of the students who was just about ready to graduate and to be ordained had a man break into her apartment and rape her. And her first instinct was that she needed to tell her bishop. Eventually, she also talked to her father about it. She was a single woman, but her first instinct is she had this enormous need to tell her bishop. She was about to be ordained and so on. And I found that sort of puzzling. And then I began to think that what she really wanted for him was not simply to give him a piece of information, because in fact it would make no particular difference, as far as I could tell, to her ordination that she would rape. But what she really, in effect, was wanting, but she didn't even know how to articulate it, she wanted healing. She really wanted, in effect, he as her most immediate sort of pastor figure to lay hands on her. But she sort of didn't even know how to name it, and so the only way she could sort of say it is, I think I need to tell him that this has happened. So that's some of the kind of things that I'm talking about in terms of all kinds of those sorts of crises, and particularly I think crises that have to do with violence and with sexual violence and so on. I think there are a lot of rites of passage that we need to rethink. And here I think we can learn something from the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition has a very rich family liturgical tradition. Every Friday night, an observant Jewish household gathers for the Sabbath meal. That's a ritual meal. It's an enormously cohesive. And I think part of one of the reasons why Jewish families are so strong is precisely that domestic liturgical tradition, the Passover. Even if a Jewish family is pretty unreligious, I mean, hardly ever goes to synagogue, they'll do the Passover. And the kids from all of the country will get back for Passover. I remember being in the airport in Boston. I taught at Harvard one year about 10 years ago. And I happened to be going to the Logan Airport to go someplace or other. And I suddenly became aware that the airport was absolutely filled with young people that looked like they were college and graduate school age. I mean, just enormous numbers of people of that age. In a way that was distinctly different than my usual experience. And as I looked at them, I began to realize that they weren't particularly wearing yarmulkes or anything. But I began to realize that not only were they enormous numbers of young people that age, but they were virtually all Jewish. And then it dawned on me that it was just about Passover. And all those kids who were all going to all the colleges in the Boston area, I'm sure that most of them were not going to synagogue on a regular basis, but they were going to get back to their families. So a lot of that kind of thing to really, I think, enrich our traditions of family worship. So let me just sort of leave it at that and have you talk to each other in small groups about areas where you'd really like some enrichment of your worship life, either in the larger community or small communities or at home and so on. And let's just see what you all come up with is what I'm suggesting. And then we'll do some discussion of that. We just, I've got about 17 up. If we just do it for about 7 minutes or so, just kind of brainstorm, what are some of the areas that you really would like some development, where you feel a kind of, a starvation for the words of God, for the symbols of healing and celebration in your life. And then let's just kind of feed back what some of you come up with, okay?
Or she, but Which may be, but I think it helps.
I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. I mean, like, you know,
there is
you
a
know, like, you're like,
I heard your sister's voice, what is she? I don't know. I mean, yes. No, it's not. I mean, the church community does. But it's the act evolving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not the institution.
That's the
we have
the meetings. Meetings, we are
praying.
So it always.
That's why.
So
she's not that traditional. She's today. She's not across the board.
No.
But I mean, at that limit,
she's.
I realize this is all too short. Can we sort of just feed back some of the ideas? Up above. Let me just put down some of the things that we were talking about up here. One person talked about better development of knowing how to do personal prayer. Somebody else was talking about a healing liturgy for failed suicide. Somebody who's tried to commit suicide and the whole gathering around that person and trying to support them.
Attempted suicide.
What were some of the other ones you were talking about? More some death and dying kind of liturgy.
Yes, not just the funeral itself, but both death and death and that degree of silence.
Yeah.
More involvement of the whole community, which is really
important. Yeah. So,
grief.
Grief, yeah, sort of grief liturgy.
We talked about life with someone enters widowhood.
Enters what?
When someone enters widowhood.
Oh yeah.
It's connected to the death and dying.
Yeah.
Like more, you know, focus on that new aspect of life. Another one was divorce.
There has been some development. Some denominations have developed a divorce liturgy.
Addiction.
It's interesting how some of the groups that do work with addicts and so on, in a sense, have a very liturgical kind of thing, and that's part of the whole therapy, is this very almost ritualized kind of thing that
AA
developed. The AA has a kind of ritualized thing. Any others?
Leave taking was one that I mentioned, when people, not death, but just separation, is people leaving the
yeah. When I was writing this book, I kept getting, every time I would mention things, people would give me another idea. They'd say, oh, I'd like this. And so the idea, for example, of a liturgy for moving from one house to another. And then some of that, yeah?
How about an empty nest? Not only leave taken, but what, how do parents readjust to not having children at home?
Uh-huh.
You know, those are actual kind of liturgies. I hope to live so long.
You know, the old joke about
it. Takes about 2 minutes.
Well, one of the liturgies, I have this book divided into four sections, and one of them is sort of rites of passage and transition liturgies. And there's liturgy for the young woman, I guess it could be Mrs. Hatzer, is that woman who is really sort of coming of age and leaving home. And she said, you know, I left home 20 years ago, my mother's never forgiven me. Well, she's about 40, is counseling, And so I would like to do a liturgy that would really create the kind of transition and new relationship that I would like to have, but I've never really had.
How about single mothers?
Single mothers.
Or single parents.
Yeah.
Could you describe one of these things? I'm sorry, I don't grasp this.
You don't grasp? Well, what I suggest is to come back tomorrow.
Oh, we're
not. What I'm planning to do, what I was trying to do here is kind of stimulate ideas of areas where people feel certain kind of needs. And then what I'm planning to do tomorrow is healing liturgies. And Wednesday, some stuff on life cycle liturgies. And I would hope that if any of you have a particular area of interest in one of these, that you might begin sketching out some thoughts about how you would do such a thing. And so that we begin to accumulate a little bit of input that we can share. Now, I've have this book here, of which there are 10 copies left in the bookstore. Sorry to say, it's a hardback. It's not a paperback yet, so it's more expensive. There is one copy of the book for the library, so you can look at it and get the idea there. But those are, will give you essentially an introduction to some of the things I have in mind. In other words, what a liturgy of leaving home might look like, but a liturgy of celebrating the transition from leaving one home and going to another might look like it. I mean, and the whole idea of this is not that this is, you know, the new prayer book that everybody's going to now repeat. This is the revised standard empty nest liturgy. Everybody's supposed to do it. But rather the notion that we are, at least on this kind of level, our own liturgies. And we begin to start shaping the things that fit our particular situation. So I'm basically trying to invite you or enable you to be liturgists, at least for these kinds of small community or family types of liturgy. But as I said, this book will at least give you, if you're mystified with something like that, what it would look like. You can look it up. The first, this book is organized with basically 10 chapters. The first 5 are sort of theological, historical background. And some of the stuff I did at the beginning of this does a little bit. The second half are ideas about liturgy, and there's a sort of a general introductory chapter. And then there's 4 chapters that follow. Those are the ones that I'll really be drawing on, and particularly chapters 8 and 9. So those have suggestions, for example, for re-envisioning, what has re-envisioning Eucharist, baptism, and so on in chapter 7. Chapter 8 has a whole series of different kinds of healing liturgies, and chapter 9 has a whole series of different kinds of rites of passage and life cycle liturgies. And there's a kind of outline here. In addition to the regular chapter elements, there's an element of the actual liturgy. So you might want to just look at that, and then hopefully some of you will come back and participate in developing some ideas around that. Yep.
Are these liturgies done incorporated in the regular service, like in a large congregation, or do you see them more in the small communities?
Well, it really depends on the community. For example, there's several liturgies here, like a divorce liturgy and some of them that were done in actual parishes. There's Methodist parish in Edison, very creative, but I think it does imply in a sense a community that has a sort of, that is a community. And many of our parishes, I think, in a sense, aren't. Yeah. I mean, so a community that has enough intentionality that you could really gather around a particular kind of thing of that sort.
That's the problem I see. You know, I can't see some of that happening in our parish at large, maybe in a small gathering.
Yeah, and I think
Wednesday night or something, but...
And I think that's where the smaller intentional communities are appropriate.
Yeah.
Or even home liturgies.
was it, but there may be some kind of, well, for example, there's a menopause liturgy in there. And I had a hysterectomy last March, and so did several of my friends who happened to be in England. And I went to England after that and did some research there. So, and so we decided to adapt this liturgy to a hysterectomy liturgy. And we gathered a whole community of people that were sort of a support community, and we sort of did this hysterectomy liturgy. The idea, and it was a rite of passage liturgy. It was moving from being one state of life to the next state of life. And so we had a whole, if you look at the menopause liturgy, you can see that the whole idea is that of a rite of passage. And we're now moving into another stage of life, and unfortunately, you know, this sort of happened with the knife rather than the processes of nature. And it was, you know, it was a very powerful liturgy, but a very appropriate one for a small support community to gather around. I mean, your average parish probably would not be the place to do it. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that's appropriate for a small attention community or a support community of some kind.
Is there a lower limit on numbers of people? I'm asking this somewhat facetiously, but for sensitivity, a liturgy, for example, can you do a liturgy by yourself?
Well, I think that in a sense that the appropriate, it's whatever is appropriate to the kind of prayer and worship experience that's going on. And so in the last chapter, I talked about seasonal liturgies, and I start out with the cycle of the day and the night, and then the week. The day and the night, I think, is very appropriate for kind of very individual prayers of rising and going to bed. Although earlier centuries or generations of Protestantism had a much more developed home prayer life, which has been almost entirely lost. I mean, the family would do morning prayer together, evening prayer together. That's been almost entirely lost. And certainly many single people have very little ministry or anybody to do that with. So I think there is a possibility of simply some kinds of worship experience that you develop yourself. From rising, going to bed, a little meditative moment, and so on.